Welcome back, and we are going to be learning today. We're now in Nach, we're in Perek Yud of Sefer Melachim, and we're going to be learning about really the self-contained idea called the Queen of Sheba. Fascinating topic. This is a very unknown topic. People do not spend so much time understanding what's really going on in this section in Tanakh. We're going to take a little bit of a perspective into it. We don't have a huge amount of time on it, but we're going to look at this. This really is actually only 13 psukim long, so it's not an incredibly long amount of period to look at in Tanakh, but we're going to spend a little bit of time on it together. So here we go. I did send the sources earlier to the WhatsApp. If you're not on the WhatsApp, please let me know, put a comment in or send me a message, and I'll make sure to add you. But in the meantime, let's learn a little bit about the Queen of Sheba. Okay, so just to put things into context, at this point in time, Shlomo HaMelech is exceptionally wealthy, exceptionally successful. Everybody around him is respecting him. He now has trade ships going down south. He has an alliance with the north. He has a relationship with the Egypt through his political marriage. So everything seems to be just great. And now we have the arrival of this very mysterious individual. Here we go. So what I'm going to do is I'd like to read very briefly the psukim in Melachim Aleph Perek Yud, the first 13 psukim. We'll take a stop. We'll try to think about things that we can learn from this. Here we go. So we're told the following about the Queen of Sheba. Umalkas Sheva, the Queen of Sheba, Shamas es Shema Shlomo Leshem Hashem. She heard what Shlomo HaMelech was doing in the name of God. Vatovol Nasos Bechidos, and she came to test him with some sort of questions or riddles. Va'tere va'tavo Yerushalayma, she came to Jerusalem. Va'chayel koved me'od, gemalim noisim besamim v'zohav, rav me'od, ve'even yekaro va'tavo el Shlomo va'tadaber elov, eiz kol asher haya im levavo. And she comes to him and she tells him, she comes with a whole bunch of things. She comes with a large host of army. She has many camels carrying spices, a lot of gold and gems. And she tells Shlomo everything that's in her heart. Vayaged lo Shlomo Esther called Vorea, and Shlomo Melech tells her all of her ideas, all of her matters. Lahaya davar ne'elam min ha'melech asher lo higid lo. There was nothing hidden from him which he did not tell her. Vatayre Malkus Sheva, Eis kol chachmas Shlomo va'abayis asher bana. He tells her about the chachma Shlomo and the house that he built. Umachal shulchano moshav avodav ma'amad mesharasov ma'bushahem, and he shows her all the way that his courtiers are dressed and his the way they operate. Umashkov the way that his drinksmen work of olasoya shiriale beis Hashem, and the way he brings sacrifices of lahya ba'oid ruach. And she had no more spirit in her. She was like really knocked over. She was bowled over. By Tomer el Amelech, and she says to the king, Emes hayoada vorashe shamati ba'artzi al dvorecha v'al chachmasecha. You know, it's amazing. It's true what they said about you, Shlomo, Solomon. It's true that they said about you that you're so wise. V'lo hemanti l'dvorim ad shashe bosi v'atirena einai. I didn't believe it until I saw it. V'hinei lo yugadli hachetzi. Even half of what was said is not even true. You're even wiser than the rumors about you. Amazing, right? So this is quite a compliment for Shlomo. Ashrei anoshecha, ashrei avodecha, eileh ha'amdim lefonecha tamir hashomim el chochmasecha. Praiseworthy be your men, praiseworthy be your servants who stand in front of you, says the Queen of Sheba. Yehi Hashem elokecha baruch, let Hashem your God be blessed. Asher chofetz b'becha litzitcha al kisei Yisrael ba'avas Hashem is Yisrael lo'olam. You should be blessed, and Hashem who made you the king should continue to bless you and make you an eternal king to do justice and righteousness. So she gives him as a gift 120 talents of gold, and much spices, and lots of gems. Never had a gift of such magnitude being given to Shlomo. V'gam oni chiram asher nasa zahav me'ofir hevi me'ofir atzas algumim harbe mo'od ve'even yakara. And she brings with her as well. She also in the ships which have brought the gold from Ophir, there was much sandalwood and precious stones which were brought in. Vayas HaMelech Atzel Gumim Misad LeBeis Hashem. He used the sandalwood as pillars or as support for the house of for the Mikdash. Ulevais HaMelech, and for his palace, V'chinaros Nevalim Lasarim, and he used them for harps and all kinds of musical instruments for his ministers. LeBochein Atzel Gumim V'Lonira Adayim Azeh. We never had such an incredible insight of this wood which came to the kingdom until this day. Amelech Shlomo Nosan LeMalchas Shiva. Es kol chefza, he gave to her everything she desired, everything she wanted. Milvad asher nosana kiyad haMelech Shlomo, beyond what Shlomo gave from the royal bounty, from the treasure houses, vatefen, vatelech laartza vihi avodeh, and she went to her land, she and her servants. So here we go. Here we have it. This is the section of Tanakh. This ends the section. You can see there's a pay at the end of this section here, or a P in the Machon Mamre's edition here, which means there's a paragraph break. The next topic is a different topic in this parak. So we have a self-contained unit over here about the Queen of Sheba. So there's a lot we can ask. We hear a lot of different details here. We hear about how she comes to Yerushalayim because she hears about him. She asks him riddles. We see that she looks at the way his house operates. We see that she is incredibly impressed, gives him gifts, and he gives her gifts. That's what we see over here. So what is going on over here? Where is she from? Who is she? What's the story with the Malkas Shiva? So the first thing we need to do is put things into context. Like, why is this here? So the answer to that is because we need to reverse the end of Perek Tes, which is what we just finished doing. At the end of Perek Tes, we saw that the king that Shlomo HaMelech had set up trade routes all the way down south to Ophir, and that's where he'd been trading gold. So the Arbabanel comments a very, very interesting point. He says, "Vihinei." The Arbabanel source one says, "Vihinei." It would seem Artzahi deramis the Eretz Israel be Eretz Kush. It would seem that her house is to the south of Israel in the land of Kush. What's Kush today? That is Ethiopia. And that's where you get good stones, and that's where you get spices. So in the Arab diction, it means something which is good. Felicia. So something which is means the name of this place is also means something which is good. It is not too far from where Israel was sojourning in the desert. That's what we call the Sinai Peninsula. So it's not too far from that, which is towards what he calls the land of the Aravis, Aravia Pnimis. We'll call it the Arab Peninsula. I would say that's the area, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. That area is in the thickness of that desert is in the thickness of the land. The Eretz Shiva he lahala asfasayam vayamzi yisavavay. It is at the bottom of that area, and the sea surrounds it. That's what we would call today a peninsula. So it sticks out at the bottom. Vayamsuf hu nichnas laoisa baoisa dhayam lamata me'aretz ahi letzad marav. And the Red Sea enters on the western side of this peninsula. Vedati noteh, and I would suggest shekasher shalach Shlomo ha'aniya shelo laofir. When Shlomo HaMelech sent off his fleet to the area of Ophir down south, and his servants went there, then suddenly people started realizing what his nature in the world. And then they said, you know, there's this miraculous king in Israel. His name is Solomon. And suddenly they started realizing, it wasn't like it was normal that people would know their knowledge like that. So she decided, if she heard that there's somebody like this, she says, I've got to find out if this is the real deal or not. That's what happened. So if you just want to take a look at the map over here, this is the map in the Daat Mikra version of the Tanakh. They have a very, very interesting map over here. So as you can see, Israel's in the top left corner over here. So there is the Sinai Peninsula is all the way at the very top. But we're talking much further down, all the way down by the Horn of Africa. So Kush is essentially where Ethiopia is today, Sudan and Ethiopia and Egypt. And on the right-hand side is the Arabian Peninsula, which is where Saudi Arabia is and Yemen and so on. So it is interesting that you see that there is at the bottom on either sides of the Straits of Tehran. The Straits of Tehran were essential, as we looked at last time, certainly in Middle Eastern policy before 1967, when Egypt was closing the Straits of Tehran. It is interesting over there that there is the whole episode over here is where Ophir can possibly be on either side of that. And you'll notice that Sheva, which is the kingdom of Sheba, is in the very bottom of that peninsula. And so it makes a lot of sense that if the trade routes of Solomon's ships, of Shlomo's ships, were coming down to Ophir, which is down there by the Horn of Africa, at the very bottom of the Yam Suf, it makes a lot of sense that the kingdom of Sheva would hear about this miraculous king called Shlomo, which is why the neighboring kingdom to Ophir, which is Sheva, would now send a delegation to Israel. Just to put things geographically into place, it makes a lot of sense. It is also worthwhile noting, if you look at the rest of the names around this area here, you see Mitzrayim, Cush, Sheva, Chatzarmaves, Yoktan, right? You see a lot of these ideas over here, Oman. So we had a lot of these names. Dedan appears over here. A lot of these names appear in earlier Bereishis as the nations coming out of the three children of Noach, but also they're the children of Avram as well, who came from the union with Keturah, who he sent out to the east. So we see a lot of those names appear in this area as well. Okay, so just to put things into perspective is where she is coming from, and as Ababinel argues, it is as a function of her hearing about Shlomo HaMelech through the trade routes. Okay, so this makes a whole lot of sense. That being the case, it is worthwhile noting that, not to burst any bubbles, but the Chida does quote the Gemara in Bava Basra, which says that Rabbi Yochanan would comment that Malkas Sheva does not mean the queen of Sheba, although Malkas generally does mean a queen. It could mean the Malchus of Sheva, which means it is referring to the king of Sheba, but it is referring to the kingdom of Sheba rather than the queen. So that definitely takes away the romantic element of it takes away the romantic element of the queen of Sheba coming in and all of the legends which surround that. But nonetheless, we should be aware that Chazal had a different take on that. Nonetheless, many of the Mefarshim do assume it was the queen, as we will see. Let me just explore a few other legends that surround this. So first of all, Josephus also in Antiquities of the Jews, he does talk about her, and he's actually very true to the text of Tanakh when it comes to this. So he has his paragraph. It's in Antiquities, volume 8, and it is paragraph 6, 5 to 6, and here's what it says. Look, it's a very long paragraph. I just want to, quote an example. I'll put it in bold over here, in the middle section, an area where he notes this. He says, "But she was beyond measure astonished at the house, which was called the Forest of Lebanon, and also the magnificence of his daily table, the circumstances of its preparation and administration, with the apparel of his servants that waited, and the skillful and decent management of their attendants. Nor was she less affected by those daily sacrifices which were offered to God, and the careful management in which the priests and Levites used about them. When she saw this done every day, she was in the greatest admiration possible, imaginable, insomuch that she was not able to contain the surprise she was in, but openly confessed how wondrously she was affected." So again, it sounds very much akin to what we saw in Melachim. What Josephus is recounting is clearly summarizing what he sees in Sefer Melachim. That's how he's writing his history in this particular point in time. So it is very true to the text. It is worthwhile noting that there are other versions of the Queen of Sheba. So in Source 5, as an example, in its Encyclopedia Britannica, many other traditions have adopted the notion of the Queen of Sheba. And that's what happens when you have religions which come after Judaism. They do cut and paste as they feel. For example, in Islam, there is a story about a woman by the name of Bilqis. She's known as the Queen of Sheba in Islamic tradition. She appears in the Quran a few times, though she's not mentioned by name. Her story has been embellished by Muslim commentators. The Arabs have also given Bilqis a southern Arabian genealogy, right? Because after all, the whole world did start in Saudi Arabia. And she is subject to the widespread cycle of legends. According to one account, Solomon having heard from the hoopoe, one of his birds, that Bilchis and her kingdom worshipped the sun, sent a letter asking her to worship God. She replied by sending gifts, but when Solomon proved unreceptive to them, she came to his court herself. The king's jinn, meanwhile, fearing the king might be tempted into marrying Bilchis, whispered to him that she had hairy legs and hooves of a donkey. Solomon, being curious about such a peculiar phenomenon, had a glass floor. It's a whole very strange story. And nonetheless, what is interesting is that it seems to be framed in the Islam as the idea of a pagan kingdom interacting with a monotheistic kingdom, and the success of the monotheism over paganism, which is very much a theme in Islam generally. It is very, very interesting. Here's a Persian rendition. This picture over here is a Persian rendition of the Queen of Sheba. And the particular story. It's also worthwhile noting that in Ethiopian tradition, they have another version of this. Ethiopian has a book called the Kebra Nagast, or Najast, which is the national epic and foundation story of Ethiopia, so they have their own history. And according to that, the Queen of Sheba, who they call Makeda, visited Shlomo at Solomon's court. After hearing about his wisdom, she stayed and learned from him for 6 months. On the last night of her visit, he tricked her into his bed. She became pregnant. She returned to his care, to her kingdom, where she bore Solomon's son, Menelik. Menelik I was made king by his father, thus founding the royal Solomonic dynasty of Ethiopia, which ruled until the deposition of Haile Selassie in 1974. So that's a pretty long period of time. Right, so they believe that they have Solomon dynasty. They have Shlomo Melech's blood in their bloodline, all the way to the 1970s. In fact, if you wanted to go further, just for those who had come to the, I gave a shiur a few weeks ago about the Raiders of the Lost Ark when we were looking at different implements in the shul. And when it comes to the ark, the Ethiopians still believe that they actually have the Aron. And because Menelik I was able to remove the Aron from the Beis HaMikdash, because after all, he was the son of Shlomo HaMelech, and that's why it ended up in Ethiopia. So if you're looking for Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana, you should be going down to Ethiopia. Nonetheless, that is one way of looking at it. But it is worthwhile that for whatever reason, this particular paragraph in Tanakh became very exciting, and lots of different legends circle this idea of the Queen of Sheba. Nonetheless, let's understand it on our own terms before it became appropriated to other people, and other people adopted it in their religious cause. So a few things to work out. So why is it that she's coming to test him? So it seems that the idea is, if you just read the psukim, is that she hears that he is divinely wise, meaning to say it sounds like she knows there's something not just that he's wise, but he's divinely wise, and she wants to see how this is. So as an example, the Abai Barnel points out, if you look at the words, it says, Sipera Kosov in source 7, Sipera Kosov Shehi Dibra El HaMelech Kol Levavah, she talked all her what was in her heart. This means she had thought about certain riddles in her mind. She never told them to anybody, not to her soul, not to her courtiers, not to her close relations. Nobody knew about the answer to this. And so therefore, the only possible way that somebody could answer them would be if they were in her heart, if they had some sort of divine intuition. And so therefore, she asked him those kind of things. What does it mean that Shlomo HaMelech told her all her thoughts, her ideas? That means to say, there was no way that Shlomo HaMelech could know what she was thinking, were it not that he had some sort of divine intuition. And that was exactly what he was testing. In fact, the Malbim gives us an example of where we see this elsewhere in Tanakh. So if you're familiar with the end of Sefer Shoftim, there's a leader who's by the name of Shimshon. Shimshon goes and decides to get married to a Philistine girl down in Gaza. Complicated story. And when he goes down there, he sets up a riddle for the family of his new in-laws. This, generally speaking, is not advisable way to start marriage. But nonetheless, he set up this riddle for everybody, and he asks them a question, which unfortunately is not a fair question. He talks them about that. He talks about Marmi Matok, or as he talks about where he slayed a lion, and a beehive was made in the carcass of the lion, and he talks about something which is sweet, which leaves something which is fierce. And there's no way to answer that riddle were you not to have seen what he saw. So I mean, you say it's not like, let's put our minds together and we can logically work out, there's three light bulbs and they're in the one room and how do you take flip two switches? Not that kind of riddle, right? It's we're talking about over here where there's no logical way of receiving this. It simply is intuitive. And it was based on the experience of one individual versus another individual doesn't have those experiences. So that's what she was doing, is she was testing him to see if he could penetrate, so to speak, her mind, which is what he did. So that's the way that our Rabbi Nel, the Malbim, understand this. It is interesting. What were the questions he asked her? So there are a few versions which are running around in different midrashim. One example of this is in the midrash at the beginning of Mishlei. So let's take a look at some of the questions that this midrash puts in as the subtext to our story and understand what she's trying to really get at. So here we go. In source 9, the midrash in Mishlei is the very beginning of Mishlei. This is like the first midrash that opens up Mishlei. It says, Ma'u b'chidos. What does it mean that she had challenges? It says, Omar Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Shalom. Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Shalom says, Omar Loi, Atahu Shlomo Sheshamati Alecho V'alachu Suchov V'alachu Chmasecho. You, Solomon the Wise, who I heard about your kingdom and your wisdom. Omar Loi Hein, he says, yes. Omar Loi, Chacham God Atah, you're a great sage. Elo, Imani Sho'eles Mimcha Dovar Echad, Atah Meshivli. Can I ask you just one idea and you'll answer me? Omar Loi, Ki Hashem Yitein Chacham V'Piv, Da'as Sunash. He responds, Hashem will give wisdom from my wisdom and from his mouth will be understanding. Wow, look at that. That's a pasuk in Mishlei. Who wrote Mishlei? Ah, you got it. Shlomo HaMelech himself. So yes, the point of this being quoted in the beginning of Mishlei is Shlomo HaMelech was saying that autobiographically. When he said that pasuk, it's referring to the idea that he was saying to her that he understands that his wisdom is not of a human origin. So what did she say? So she said, So what do you have? Seven exiting, nine entering, two which put forth energy, and one which absorbs energy. That's the question. Now, complicated riddle. What is going on over here? Says, of course, it refers to the birthing process. There is the seventh day of the menstrual cycle, 9 months of the birthing process. There are the woman nurses with her two breasts, and the child absorbs the energy and drinks and grows. Which means to say, we're talking about the source of life is essentially in the cycle of 9, 9, 7, 2, 1. That's the way that she asked him, and he automatically understood. Amra loy, chacham gorata, ilam ani sho'eles mimcha davar acher. Maybe you've been studying that mashal. What about if I ask you something else? No, it's up to Hashem. So Amar Lai, she asks in the second riddle, Mahu, Isha Amar Livna. A woman says to her son, Avicha Avi, your father is my father, Ziknucha Baali, your grandfather is my husband, Va'at Bari, you my son, Va'ana Achoseich, and I'm your sister. It's complicated just listening to that. Right, so what's going on over here? What's the answer to the riddle? Amar Lai, Vai, says, you don't read Bereshis? He says, Shtei benois ha-shalotain. Those are the daughters of Lot, of course, but they're both the sister and the mother of this of the child, because they had a child from their father, thereby making the father and grandfather the same person. Okay, so that's the way he answers it. She made another example. She brought in front of him children of very similar appearance, similar clothing. Can you separate the males from the females? So he called his courtiers. He threw on the ground nuts, aka today candy, right? So he gave them treats. And he threw them on the floor in front of them. So the boys, what they do, they immediately lifted up their skirts and started putting all the loot into it. Whereas the girls were a little more sensitive and mature, and they took their kerchief and they put it into that. So you're incredible. That's how do you know that? Fourth case the Midrash brings, she brought in front of him men who are circumcised and men who are not circumcised. Amar loy, hafreshli mina mu'alim mina arelim. Can you distinguish between the two? Now, she probably did not mean to say do a check. She said, how do you know who they are? So miyad ramaz lekayin gadol pasach aron habris. And so what he did was he opened up the Ark of the Covenant. Mu'alim shebahen karu b'chatzikomos and v'loy oed shel el shenusmane penei miziv ashkena. those who were circumcised were forced over double, and but through their face the Shekhinah would shine. And those who were uncircumcised fell upon their faces, completely collapsed. They couldn't stand in the face of the Shekhinah. Okay, so they were not requisite kelim to be able to accept the Shekhinah. Fascinating. So this is what the Midrash says. It is interesting to note that is there like a common theme? Can you put all the beads onto one chain here? So the truth is that Rav Yigal Ariel. I want to see if I have it over here. I had it here before. Oh, Rav Yigal Ariel in his commentary on Melachim has a very fascinating insight, where he says, and which is over here, where he says that all these questions, one of the underlying principles over here is boundary, which means to say that what is being said over here is the idea of the separation of boundaries. The way he says it is, kol achad hachidos matzbiot ez atishtush al shelat chumim. What she was asking him was the breakdown of boundaries, whether it be the idea of, as she says, lo nikar kol hevdel ben Yisrael la'amim, what she says is like, you know, the boundaries, let's say, between male and female, between girl and boy, between Israel and the rest of the nations. What she was asking is what distinguishes people? What distinguishes nations? What makes people set aside? What makes you think that you're so special? And essentially the debate that was going on then and the debate which continues to go on to now is surely everybody's equal. Surely everybody has their own, is able to do everything the same. And it seems that what Shlomo Melech is saying is that there is different domains for different people, for different nations specifically as well, which is one way of looking at this. I think it's a very fascinating suggestion as to try to understand this. There are other midrashim which do suggest other questions that he asks, that were asked of her, but asked from her to him. But nonetheless, this is one level of it which seems to be a little bit different. You see, you notice that, by the way, these questions are questions which are not like the Malbim that Abarbanel suggested, which are things that only she knew, but they're more about intellectual questions of, so to speak, the independence of Israel, the uniqueness of Israel more specifically. So it is interesting, by the way, to notice that what was the most impressive thing for her was not even the answering of the riddles. What was it that made her so impressed? Was the order of his palace, the way that everything worked. It's worthwhile thinking about why that is. Why was more impressive to her the way everything worked, the order, the clothing, than it was actually the riddles that he answered. But be it as it may. At the end, we're told that he gives her everything she wanted. Kol asher chafta. Everything she wanted. What does that mean? So the Malbim says in the source 11, "Va'amelach shlomo nosan lemalchus shavah is kol chefzah she shalom bedvarim shiras ba'oitzar amelach v'tachpats bohem." So he took her on a tour of the royal chambers, and he said, "Anything you want, you take." So he had a lot of respect for her. She was obviously a powerful figure in the region, and he let her have carte blanche when she went through his treasure chambers. The Radak has a slightly different perspective in source 12. He says, "Mil vara asher nosan lo." So what did he give her? He gave her everything which had a proudly Israel stamp on it. Right? So anything which had been produced in Israel, which could not be produced elsewhere, was what he gave her, which makes a lot of sense, right? So Israel's exporting unique products. So he gives her, not just the gold and money and so on as a sign of trust and an alliance, but he gives her things which are unique to the land of Israel. And that is what he gave her. It is interesting, though, that Rashi does comment a little bit differently. He makes another point, and this is where you can see the divergence of other legends arrive. It's interesting that in this Rashi, there's a parenthesis which is quoted from the Ari. I'm not sure if this was later on or it's Rashi's original text. But it says, Kol chefza ba'alev nolad mimenu Nevuchadnezzar. Quoting, this seems to be a Medrash, that they had a relationship and they had a child who ultimately was the predecessor of Nebuchadnezzar, who was the Babylonian king, Ve'echriv Habayis She'omad Arba Me'os Ve'eser Shanim Bechelek Kol Shnem Asar Shvatim. And he ended up destroying the Beis HaMikdash. Milvad Asher Nosan La Matanos Migdonos Medah Metsuyun Kan Ve'enah Metsuyun Bimkoma. Besides the other gifts that he gave her, like the Radak says, which were only to be found in Israel. So when you read this, it seems that there's a little bit of a darker side to it, which means to say it doesn't. The Rashi does not indicate who initiated this relationship, but nonetheless, it does indicate that there was a relationship and there was a child that came out of this. Now, this is where, of course, the Ethiopians take their their idea of this person called Menelik the First. That's where they get it from. But the idea of this is, and by the way, their version of history came after Rashi was even written, just to for the sake of posterity. But it is interesting to note that there seems to be a negative perspective in this. I mean, to say what the Medrash which Rashi is quoting seems to be indicating is that this was not a healthy relationship, because ultimately from it bore the seeds of destruction itself, even though Yishlam HaMelech was the creator of this. And I think there's something to be said about that. I want to come back to that in just a moment. Because I was looking through a book called From David to Destruction, The Rise and the Fall of Shlomo HaMelech. He believes that there's something troubling. This is what he says. However, upon closer scrutiny, there seems to be some troubling aspects of this visit. Malkat Sheva is impressed by elegant clothes, food, drinks, servants of the Shlomo HaMelech's kingdom. She is also overwhelmed by Shlomo's wisdom. No explicit mention is made of being impressed by the beauty of the Torah and its laws. This leads us to wonder whether she's impressed merely by Shlomo HaMelech's style and not as much by the substance of Shlomo HaMelech's spirituality. In addition, Malkat Sheva's visit stands out as the only visit by a foreign dignitary who expresses positive feelings about Hashem. Perhaps the exception of the Phoenician king Hiram. Where are the other kings who visit and are motivated to praise Hashem? It seems that this never happened. That's Shlomo Melech's dream, to positively impact the leaders and the peoples of the world to recognize Hashem, hardly materializes. Moreover, Menachem 10:13 records Malkat Sheva returned to her land, but does not mention an attempt on her part to inspire her subjects in the belief of Hashem as one of as the one and only God. So he views this as opposed to being a positive description. He says this is a negative description because she was the only one who came, and ultimately she was impressed by the superficiality rather than the inner beauty. I personally think that this is a misreading, and for a number of reasons. First of all, Tanakh is not a history book, so they could have had dignitaries coming every other Tuesday, and Tanakh wasn't recording them because it wasn't relevant for us for the Doras. So it's very hard to say that this is the only annals of Judaic history, and therefore to make a comment as if this is the only foreign visitor, I would be very reticent to make such a generalization. And moreover, I think that there is a point which is being made here, which is true, but I think that it relates basically to Shlomo HaMelech himself, and I think there is a reason why this story is highlighted more than others. And the reason is the following. If we read Mishlei Perek Lamed Aleph, which is the 31st and last chapter of the book of Mishlei, we're told about the following. Who wrote the book of Mishlei again? Just to make sure we got it correctly, is Shlomo HaMelech himself. So it's very worthwhile listening to him and thinking about his words autobiographically. Here's what he says at the beginning of the 31st Perek of Mishlei. Divrei Lemuel Melech Maso Asher Yisratu Imoi. We're told about a king by the name of Lemuel, who records the message of rebuke he received from his mother. So according to many of the Mepharshim, this refers to that Shlomo HaMelech is now incorporating into Sefer Mishlei the ideas and the Mishalim of other kings that he heard. And there was a person by the name of Lemuel, and there's a debate as to who Lemuel could be. Many Mepharshim, though, do say that's actually Shlomo HaMelech himself. It refers to Shlomo himself, and he's referring to the rebuke he got from his own mother, whose name was Bathsheba. Okay, so he's recording this. What is the words of admonishment that he's recording? So here we go. No, my son. No, son of my womb. No, son of my vows. Don't give your strength to women, your vigor to those who destroy kings. What Bathsheba was warning Shlomo, her son, or the mother Lemuel was warning Lemuel, was saying is, be careful what relationships you have. Be careful who you give your allegiances to, because ultimately they will destroy you. And what seems to be being pointed out over here is be very, very careful as a king about who it is that you can really, truly have a relationship with. Who are they interested in you, or are they interested in your wealth and power? What is it that is going to be of interest to them? And moreover, on your side, who are you? And there seems to be something very autobiographical over here, because as we're going to see, Shlomo HaMelech has a problem in this arena towards the end of his rule, and this becomes one of his undoings. And we already see it over here, perhaps, when it comes to the Malkus Shavah. It is worthwhile noting that the end of the Perek perhaps gives Shlomo HaMelech a little bit of a different voice. And the end of the Perek of Lamed Aleph in Mishlei is a Perek which we all should all know off by heart, because we say it every week, and that is Eishes Chayil Miyimtza. The end of Mishlei, from Pasuk Yud onwards, is Eishes Chayil, with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, goes on afterwards. So what Shlomo Melech is describing is, in a certain sense, this wistful journey or search for the Eish Eschayil. He's trying to find this woman of valor, Verochet Mipnini Michra, but is with the introduction of his mother, which is, be very careful who you engage a relationship with. Which means to say that Shlomo Melech is, so to speak, caught in this tension, trying on the one hand to listen to the advice of being careful, now on the other hand, with this eternal search for this fleeting image of an Eish Eschayil. Now, what is interesting about this is that maybe this explains, Rav Yigal Ariel El explains, I think it's a very profound insight, what Shlomo Melech was trying to do. You understand that Shlomo Melech's great-great-grandmother was a woman by the name of Rus HaMoaviyah, right? That means to say that you have a woman who came from a foreign neighboring kingdom, who came to the land of Israel and decided to become, so to speak, Israelite herself. She converted and she brought with her great aspects of the society she left. And ultimately, not only was she a contributor, but she became the Imah Shel Malchus, as we're going to see at the end of this parish. She became the scion, she became the mother of the kingdom. Perhaps in Shlomo Melech's search for the Eish Eschayil Miyimtza, in his search for that woman of valor, which is a projection of the image of his own great-grandmother, he sees the coming of this particular woman also from the outside, also with astonishment, also with wonder about his kingdom. But perhaps he sees in her not the warning of Lemuel, but rather the statement of Eish Eschayil Miyimtza as well, reflected on Rus herself. It's interesting that this is the way that Rav Yigal Ariel words it in Midrash Melech. I put it in the 16th and last source for today. Shlomo b'musarov chashash mina isha zara. He worries about many times in Mishlei, the strange woman. He made many warnings. Like zilchami isha zara, mi nachriya maria chechlika, v'lama tishke b'ni b'zara v'techabek chek nachriya. Many, many times in Mishlei, he warns against relationships with somebody outside of, so to speak, your cultural, your Judaic circle. But he said at the same time he's searching for who the real Eish Eschayil is. Who tier oisa kasher pu apal tanit apal tanit bioter hamikrena or umashpia kol tov al ba'ala v'kol sviva. He describes at the end of the parak as this incredible source of light for his surroundings. Efshar shebebekashasoi es perhaps in the eyes of his imagination, he would see the image of his great grandmother, Es Rus. She came in her own initiative to join to the nation of Israel. She got above, so to speak, the destruction of her house. Nesta Imma Shamachus became the mother of the king. Rus achen huchter b'fi kol b'kino izeh ki yodeh kol shar ami ki Eish Eschayil at. Boaz says to Rus, I know you're an Eish Eschayil. So that was the exact name given to Rus. So it's not that he's using, why is Eish Eschayil said he called Eish Eschayil, because Shlomo Melech is recreating the image of his great grandmother. That's why she's called an Eish Eschayil, because that's what she was called. Therefore, one can distinguish between two women coming into the sphere of Israel. To the one who is coming to build, invest, and care about the nation of Israel, so that a woman who comes maybe in astonishment, but at the end of the day, it doesn't make any inner penetration. So what we see over here is a woman who does come in, and it sounds like it's very close to a Rus experience. If you think about it, she's wondrous. She says, "Wow, it's incredible! Look at your God! Look at the way it works! Look at the offerings! Look at the house! You're so wise! You got intuition, which is divine, incredible." So all these things seem to be lining up, but in the end of the day, as was pointed out in the previous citation, that by in this book From David to Destruction, she ends up going back to her kingdom, right? In the end of the day, she ends up going back to her kingdom. We don't hear anything about her afterwards. So obviously the impact was only so deep. The impact was only so superficial, essentially. And that distinguishes between Shlomo HaMelech's own struggle in understanding and appreciating perhaps who a Rus could be, or vice versa, who the Queen of Sheba could be. And it's this lost projection which is what complicates, but at the same time enriches this experience of Shlomo HaMelech, and perhaps will be one of his greatest struggles later.